This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2008, Pamela White began writing a book called The Genius of Marion. The subject, her mother, the accomplished painter Marion Williams Steele, who suffered from Alzheimer's before she died in 2001. A year later, Pam was herself diagnosed with the disease. She was then 61. Pam's son, Banker White, filmed the early stages of his mother's decline. Here is Pam talking to her doctor in 2001.
And can you tell me what year it is?
This is the one that makes me mad, because it's something I should know immediately.
That's tough, yeah. I know.
Tell me again.
What year is it?
19-something.
Okay.
Banker White's documentary film, The Genius of Marion, is an intimate, sometimes heartbreaking portrait of a family watching the mother that they knew overtaken by Alzheimer's. The film makes its television debut as the season opener for PBS's POV series on September 8th. And the filmmaker Banker White joins us with more. Banker, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So when did this story turn into a film for you?
That's a really good question, because, you know, when my mom was officially diagnosed, that came after about 4 years of confusion, of just kind of wondering what was going on with her. I lived in San Francisco and there in the Boston area. And, you know, every time I came home, would really try and check in with her. And when she was officially diagnosed, after conversations with my dad, I just felt like it was important that I try and move home and see what kind of support I could offer. So I did that in the fall of 2009. And I probably filmed with her for more than a year before I admitted really to myself and then began a dialogue with everyone that I thought that this was incredibly powerful material. And I kind of started to have a different conversation with my mom initially about making the film. Mm. I'm the only grandson of Marion's who identifies as being an artist. She was just a real hero to me. So to be with my mother talking about this woman who was so important to me, and in a way like inching towards talking about my mom's diagnosis because it was still very difficult for her. Mm. So since Marion had Alzheimer's, we could kind of very carefully get into that territory. And throughout the year, my mom opened up and started speaking to me quite openly about what it felt like to be diagnosed.
Let's get first to your mother's very full, interesting life. Tell us a little bit about her history.
She was and is an incredibly beautiful woman. And she was a stage actress, and in her kind of later teens and 20s was a model. And she did everything from runways to print catalogs and television. A lot of people actually, there's a clip of her selling Aerodextra Dry in the film. And a lot of people who have actually reached out to me who've seen the film, and the first thing they say is, I remember that commercial.
I'm a fashion model, and when you have to change 7 or more times in 45 minutes, you really need added protection. And because of this, I use Aerodextra Dry.
And then as my mom became a mother and I was born, she transitioned out of being a model and went to school for social work. And I think was an incredibly gifted social worker and therapist. And then, of course, kind of skipped the most important part. She was an incredible mother, very supportive of her three children.
Well, I certainly felt a lot of identification with the pain of it and the powerfulness and also the sense of seeing positivity. My mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's a little more than a year ago. She's much older than your mom. But this idea of seeing somebody who was once the glue and the caretaker, and this is clear in your family, who becomes the one who needs to be driven around and watched and changed. We see your mother unable to spell her name. She can no longer remember phone numbers. She at one scene puts a coat on and off and on and off and looks lost, but she is kind of aware and unaware of what's happening to her. But you know, you're a filmmaker watching these scenes, taking this footage and watching these scenes over and over and over again. What was that like for you?
She is the type of person that has spent so much of her life and really identified as someone who helped others, that you never really worried about her needing getting help from us. And I mean, almost to the point of it being a fault, where I wouldn't say that she ever had a false smile, but she was so together that it was easy for her to project an incredibly positive energy onto any situation, mm-hmm. which I think is really healing. I don't look at that as denial. I think the idea that I'll just use that smile, her smile, as it being a source of optimism, I think that it's healing, and it's both of these things. But when it is kind of trying to cover up the really intense embarrassment, mm-hmm. The shame, mm-hmm. but in the beginning, I think it was more emotional. It was actually that awareness that you're talking about. It was watching her struggle with something. It's easy to walk up and lend a helping hand, and everything moves forward beautifully. We're all a tight, loving family, and we have a nice support network of friends. But when you offer help, and that offer to care for this person who's clearly struggling actually somehow offends them or saddens them, that was the most difficult thing.
I want to pick up on that doctor's visit that we heard a little bit from earlier, when your father's basically saying, you know, I'm not so good at this, and your mom is resisting getting outside help.
There are just some things I'm not that good at. You know, I don't know how to put your makeup on.
Mm. You're really good at it.
Yeah, that's what you say. I do dress you, but I'm not that good at it. Uh-huh. You know, the showers and the baths and mm-hmm. all that stuff is... Mm-hmm. You could really get better help than me, but that's the big issue.
Uh-huh.
I think the problem is that it's kind of like my, how do you say it? Pride.
But your father really bears the brunt of the caregiving. There's with a lot of sweetness and generosity, but we also get little glimpses of his frustration as he tries to keep her active. And this shows up particularly in one scene. He wants to bring her out on the boat. It's a windy day. She just doesn't want to go. And you ask her, you know, to describe what's happening or describe the scene, and she calls it hell. Let's hear a little bit more.
What do I do?
Just come over here, hold my hand, and step in the boat.
I don't want to.
Oh, all right, let's just go sit in her ass for the rest of our life. Jesus Christ. Come on, Mom. Here, bring me right back if it's terrible.
So powerful scene from the film The Genius of Marianne. Banker White is with us. He's the director of the film, and he was there. And we hear you sort of trying to cheer the whole process along. You know, the role that you're playing and you're witnessing as a filmmaker, but you also have to, as a filmmaker, show us all of the lapses, right? You know, you have to communicate to us, like, the worst. I'm just wondering about how your family felt about seeing themselves at not necessarily their best moments.
In terms of the relationship with the family, I think that it's really constant communication, and that you, for example, I went to the doctor with my mom and dad multiple times, sometimes as a son, but I did also ask to film, and there's clear communication about that beforehand. So when you do go and film what is kind of real life in that more observational role, there's this foundation of trust, and I'm not kind of storming into rooms with a camera blazing without having had some prior discussion with everybody about it. But then with a situation like this, of course, and the length of time that I was there, and I think also just the level of comfort that they have with me, people become unaware of the camera. So you are able to film things that are a reflection of, you know, real life. And so I filmed lots of times when people became frustrated, and that boat scene, I think, in some ways, it's because my dad's trying so hard to go. I mean, it's like this Clark Griswold kind of a darker version of that, maybe, when he's trying. I mean, it was like literally, it was like right before Hurricane Sandy. It was like early fall. It was not a beautiful boat day, to say the least, and getting on the boat is something that my mom's never liked to do. But I do think represents very much this idea that we're going and we're doing it as a family, and this is the thing that we always used to do. So let's continue to do it. And as you're saying, I'm there not just filming it, but encouraging her, because in the house, I just was like, my dad needs this. We need to do this. It's true. My mom, she's just been sitting on the couch for a week. We need to go and all. It's so easy to believe that it's the right thing to do. And so it's a great example of what it feels like to be in a, you know, for my dad, a love relationship with someone who's changing.
Hmm. How about your mom? What did she think of the film?
I think the question of whether she was aware is not a, it's difficult to answer that question in terms of, it's not a yes or no answer. And that's true, not just of her awareness of something like a film festival, but all aspects of her life. What I do know is that she had very positive experiences at every public screening of the film. We watched the film in a close to finished state multiple times and communicated well about it. She'd say little things like, I think this is good. Hmm. I think this is a good thing. Isn't this a good thing? And I know as a son, you want to hear that because you want to believe that she believes that sharing these things is a good thing. But you also want to believe that there is that kind of awareness, though she's paralyzed in other ways with her use of language and access to memories is very difficult. Even today, she has these little nuggets of insight, and you wonder where it came from because she seemed not like you hadn't accessed that part of her for a long time. And so there's something about intense social energy, large groups of people being focused on one thing, where so far the being present at the screenings has been a very positive experience. You know, people hugging her in the lobby afterwards. It's all been positive.
Yeah. Well, Banker White, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Banker and his wife and producing partner, Anna Fitch, made the documentary film The Genius of Marion. It's going to be making its television debut as the season opener for PBS's POV series on September 8th. You can see a trailer on our website, wordofmouthradio.org, but there's also a big storytelling component where people can share their own stories of dealing with Alzheimer's and their family at thegeniusofmarion.com. We'll have a link at wordofmouthradio.org. People living with dementia can appear to live in their own world, a complicated, non-linear inner world not so easily communicated to or understood by others. There are few tools to help ease the isolation experienced by many with the syndrome. The London-based writer Susanna Howard is attempting to give people with dementia a voice, visiting them and recording their words as poetry.
Comments on language and words. Sometimes you don't feel on top of the world. You think, I wish something like this or that happened, I could remember better. The whole life is a mystery. We can assume what we can assume will happen to us, but we can't force it to happen. Every year that you are growing up puts different words into your mind. We are changing for the worse or the better. Sometimes you don't feel on top. The point is, when you are talking about one thing, your mind is going in different directions. Yes, sometimes in conversation you use words that weren't intentional, but they fit. We got to be a gold mine practically of words, can stir something else up. Think, wish, remember.
Susanna is artistic director of Living Words. It's an arts and literature program helping people with dementia feel understood and heard, even when communication may seem lost. Susanna, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Lovely. It's fantastic to talk to you.
How did you get the idea for Living Words?
Well, I went through a personal experience of really losing myself, actually, and was going through a lot of internal pain and conflict and didn't want to sort of seek any sort of medical help for this. And so I sat and I did have some time, which was a real privilege, and I had paper and pen and I just wrote and I wrote and was just sort of getting everything out of me. And through that process, I was able to begin to find myself again. And then I thought, well, this gives an opportunity here in working with other people. And I found out that there were arts organisations that were linked to hospitals that would support perhaps this kind of work. So I pitched this idea and they said to me, we like your intention, but we only have money for the elderly care unit and for people with dementia. I said, okay. And it suddenly started to click together. I just came out just knowing that this was the right path for me. That first placement, there was a woman there who I worked with, and she really taught me a lot, and she had advanced dementia. And when we finished working together, she looked into my eyes and she said, "Now you know two worlds, the one outside and the one inside in me, and you've got to go and tell all the people." I've held that and kept that as my mission.
Well, I'd love you to talk to us a little bit more about that process of assembling poems for a patient. First of all, you find them mostly in care homes or caregiving situations there in the UK. Is there much editing or input, or you just talk to them and you just record exactly as it is?
Well, it's a real technique that I've developed over the time. We work one-on-one with residents, and we sit. Really important part of the process is being able to sit in silence and just be together. And we use eye contact, connecting through the eyes. And really, I like people who do the work to be able to have their own meditation practice, because that can quiet the noise that we can sometimes have in our head. And let me tell you, people with Alzheimer's and dementia know if you're not focusing on them and know if there's something going on or if you're palming them off. So we just sit together, and sometimes we sit for a long time in silence. I have my paper and pen, or whoever's doing it has their paper and pen, and that's really a bridge between us. When they speak, the person sees me writing their words down, and it's sort of an act that happens between us. And I have the recorder as well, and the recorder is just there so that we can go back and check that everything is correct, because we don't want to be putting words in people's mouths. So we write the words down, and then we edit it by taking things out, but we don't change the meaning or the way they came together. We might put themes together, perhaps. Sometimes you can think, gosh, if there was an extra word here that they hadn't said, this would really be profound, or really, you know, this would clearly get what they're saying across. But we don't never do that.
Let's hear just a little bit more of some of the work of Living Words, a collaboration between Susanna Howard, who we're speaking to today, and a number of different patients with dementia.
Number 65. This chair, it's so dirty feeling. I'm not in running order. Where do you go to when you go out? I keep out of walking mode with the mainframe in the convoy. Don't go around much. I wish I could drive in a big car. Drive away in a car. I wish I could fly right away to number 65, not drifting along at nothing.
You are releasing these poems, you know, to the world as creative works. And I suppose, you know, poetry is not required to make sense in the same way that we expect from prose. I mean, what is it about poetry and creative writing that helps people with dementia, do you think?
Well, I think perhaps there's another angle of coming at it. There's a lot of people that I'm working with are more advanced in their dementia, which is, or with their experience of dementia, which is that their experience in their brain and their mind is an expression that is used a lot. Is you're moving from your head to your heart. In terms of the brain, you're sort of moving from your left side to your right side more. There's more free space there because we live in a society where we're made to sort of organize and be logistical a lot of the time. And so I feel that the words that need to be said just come up, and they may happen to be metaphorical. Someone may be searching for something and they say an alternate word, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't make sense. It means that it perfectly describes what they're trying to say.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what it's like for you. I mean, you're hearing people describe, in some cases, feeling locked in, feeling kind of isolated by their condition. Is it difficult to hear that kind of pain that must come across in some of these poems?
I wouldn't say it's difficult for me. How I feel about it is I feel when I'm with the person that it's enriching them and me for them to be able to say it and for it to be heard. And what is more alive than that? That sharing of what existence feels like for each of us, whether we have dementia or not.
Do you see changes or improvement in patients after working with them?
Yes, you can. And I think we need to be able to communicate with each other, and I think that sometimes for the care industry, it's not the best thing to have lots of people who have dementia being able to express themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's the line there?
It's a line between money and, you know, what we could say, you know, what is right for people. but it's going to cost more. You could say that's the thinking, but the reality is that talking and communicating and not feeling that sense of isolation, that feeling utterly depressed. If I was to stay in some care homes that I've worked in, I'm sure within a month I would certainly be clinically depressed and I would be displaying the signs of dementia. The reality is it's a lot cheaper to have people doing arts work than it is for them to be taking pills, but you know, the arts and the medical, you know, the pharmaceutical companies, well, there's always one that's richer.
Well, is it? I mean, is it cheaper? I mean, what we understand is that people sort of get warehoused and maybe taking antidepressant drugs is easier and cheaper than this kind of work. So what is your argument that it's actually cheaper to do the creative work?
Yes, I mean, I can't talk money or anything like that, but it's something that in this country is being talked about a lot. Because what you're not just looking at the medicine. What you're looking at is if someone's engaged and feeling not so isolated, then they're not going to have as many falls necessarily. They're not going to have as many admissions into hospitals.
How do the people that you work with react when you read their poems back to them?
Well, with Living Words, what we do is we have the poems put into books for every individual. They have their Living Words books. Even if they've just said one word over all our time together, they have their book. And then that book is a bridge between the carer and their relative and the person, because we really don't want the work to just be a flying in and flying out. We want to help people be continuing their communication. We work with staff on that. But how do people react when I read their words back to them? They say, yes, yes. Some people shout out. Some people are saying the words along. Some people take a long time to respond. Then they say, oh, there's a man I worked with who took 10 minutes to respond every time. And his words after I'd read his poem out was, it's a call to arms, like positive action. And a woman most recently said to me, and you don't want to overstate things, but she said, you doing this, writing my words and reading them back to me, it's like medicine for me.
Well, a big yes and thanks to you for joining us, Susanna.
Thank you.
Susanna Howard, London-based writer, artistic director of Living Words. She takes the words of people living with dementia and turns them into poetry. You can read some of them at wordofmouthradio.org and learn more about Living Words there. More word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stars, they're just like us. Americans gobble up grainy pictures of them on their beach vacations, coming out of the gym, walking their kids to school. And this week, you and everybody else with an internet connection could have clicked on nude photos of Jennifer Lawrence, Ariana Grande, and a number of other celebrities posted on the internet, courtesy of a hacker who infiltrated their personal iCloud accounts. So did you click on the naked pictures of celebrities? And what are the ethics of clicking, anyway? I posed that question, to click or not to click, on Facebook. And here are responses from a few of my friends. Cherie said, why would I bother? I've seen naked women before. Ron said, I admit, at first I was thinking it would be interesting, but just like viewing beheading videos, some things are better left unwatched. Ron's response points to another choice that internet users have been given, whether or not to watch the Islamic State's slickly produced videos of the gruesome execution of journalist James Foley 2 weeks ago and that of Stephen Sotloff this week. We've reached an interesting point in our digital culture when just about anything, from celebrity gossip to much more prurient interests, are just a click away. Many of us now understand that the curiosity leading us to open that Pandora's box of sites we cannot unsee has a cost to ourselves and to others. I did not look myself. Instead, I was much more fascinated to see so many regular folks defending the personal privacy of celebrities that are, in so many other ways, considered to be fair game. Is it our own privacy we're projecting concern for? Are these polished gods and goddesses on the red carpet vulnerable human beings, just like us? Perhaps the question people are asking is, how do I make sure my photos stay private? Alex Goldman tackled that question in the latest episode of the podcast TLDR.
The best way to protect yourself is just don't take scandalous selfies. Don't take nude photos of yourself.
This is Kashmir Hill. She's written about tech and privacy for Forbes since 2010. This week, stolen naked pictures of a large group of celebrities circulated on the internet. But Kashmir's already lived through some version of this story a bunch of times. In 2013, it was Demi Lovato. In 2012, it was Olivia Munn and Prince Harry. In 2011, it was Anthony Weiner and Scarlett Johansson. And this extends back at least to Paris Hilton a decade ago. But this latest leak made her realize that her impulse to blame the person in the photo was wrong. Before, it seemed simple. If you don't want naked pictures of yourself on the internet, don't take naked pictures of yourself.
There are many articles where I've said that. This is the hard thing about being a writer, that your positions are captured. But I just don't think it's good advice to give anymore.
According to the Pew Internet Research Project, 9% of people have sent nude photos and 20% have received them. That's up from 6% and 15% respectively in 2012. And I'm sure that that number is much higher than people are self-reporting.
I think it's just part of relationships now, along with kissing and making out and circling the bases. I think we, you know, send dirty photos to each other. It's just kind of part of digital courtship.
Kashmir says the same thing probably happened when Polaroids were invented. Technology gave people the ability to do this thing, so they did more of it. Plus, every time a celebrity's photos get sent around, it's actually an advertisement for sexting. Stories about celebrities who sext normalize the idea for a larger audience. I mean, how weird can taking pictures of yourself naked be if every actor under the sun's doing it?
So rather than telling people not to do this, knowing that they're not going to take that advice, kind of like preaching sex abstinence, I'd rather give people advice on how to protect themselves when they are kind of conducting their relationships this way.
Is there an equivalent of a condom for sending erotic photographs?
So much like sex itself, there's no surefire way to protect yourself against STDs, pregnancy, or heartbreak. Condoms break and birth control sometimes fails. And so I can't say that there's definitely a way to send a selfie and ensure that it never gets out in a way that harms you. But it's part of the reason Snapchat was so popular from the very beginning. And it's something that they kind of promoted in the use of the app was for sexting, because you're sending this photo to somebody, they get to look at it for 1 second to 10 seconds and it disappears. And then another thing you can do is encrypt files so that when they're in the cloud, somebody who got access to them wouldn't be able to look at them unless they have an additional password.
But even Snapchat, I would say it has a failure rate much greater than condoms.
I think Snapchat is actually not the best app to use, and there are other apps that have been created for safer sexting, including Glimpse, Wickr, Silent Circle. These are apps that have better security built in. But yeah, that's the problem too. When you create these images, you're sharing them with somebody, and you have to hope that their security practices are good as well, or you know that your relationship doesn't go sour and they don't decide to post the images. So there are a lot of things that have to change. One of them is this kind of societal attitude towards what you can do with those photos.
We were talking about sort of like technical prophylaxis, trying to figure out ways to technically keep yourself safe. But I mean, judging by your last answer, I'm wondering if it's a mistake to even focus on tech. I mean, is it really just about adopting a set of social mores that keep people from doing this because it's just reprehensible?
I think that should be part of it, that when these images are shared, that we treat them respectfully. I don't think we can limit it to social mores, but I do think the technical part has to be part of this. I think people have to practice better technological security, and then I think companies need to protect us. So one interesting suggestion I saw come from this whole debacle is, you know, Google and Apple have private browsing windows.
Right.
So that you can look up certain things without it being captured in your browser history or leaving cookies on your computer. It would be wonderful if they had something similar for photos. So as they push us to back up more and more of our photos in the cloud, which is great because I don't want to lose photos from my recent trip to Hawaii, they should have an option to say, right now I want to take a private photo. This is a photo that I'm only sending to, you know, a significant other, and I don't want this one backed up.
Well, you know, one of the ways that this safe sex analogy begins to break down is with sexually transmitted diseases and pregnancy, you know potentially what will limit your risk. Whereas in the case of computing, there are forces constantly at work trying to procure this information, either from you or from celebrities or from whomever. There are people constantly trying to figure out vulnerabilities to these services. And I'm wondering if this is something that we should think about legally.
So I actually profiled this DOJ and FBI unit in LA who focus on these cases that involve nude photos that are hacked or stolen and distributed. And this one FBI agent, I thought this was pretty profound, was that part of the problem is that we see these cases as a violation of privacy. But what he's thinking about when he's pursuing them is that taking someone's nude image they meant to share with one person and then stealing that is a kind of digital sexual assault. But if we thought about it like that, it might change the way that we create laws around this. And honestly, I think that there's been a societal change. 3 years ago, when this happened to Scarlett Johansson and other celebrities, there were far more people who posted links to the photos. This time, I haven't been seeing that. And when I do see people talking about this, they're talking about it less as this is a nude photo scandal and more as this is a crime against these women. And I'm really happy to see that shift in coverage.
Kashmir Hill writes the Not So Private Parts blog for Forbes.
TLDR is produced by Alex Goldman and PJ Vogts and hosted by Alex Goldman. How about you? Did you look at the nude photos of celebrities leaked on the internet? Would you admit to it if you did? Is looking at them akin, as some accuse, to committing a sex crime? Do celebrities have the same right to privacy as we do? You can join the to click or not to click conversation on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. When we come back, given all we know about football, is it immoral to watch it? The case against football, sure to be a provocative discussion. Stay with us for that right after the break when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In January of this year, a week before Super Bowl Sunday, the writer Steve Almond posed a provocative question in the New York Times Magazine. A lifelong football fan, he asked, is it immoral to watch the Super Bowl? The article went crazy viral, and he was praised for raising the question in some quarters and accused of being a crybaby who should, quote, iron his panties in others. In a new book called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto, Steve Almond argues that allegiance to football legitimizes and even fosters within us a tolerance for violence, greed, racism, and homophobia. Well, given that the kickoff for the first official Patriots game of the season is less than 30 minutes away, this may be his last chance to win over any New England football fans. Steve Almond, New York Times bestselling author, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I want you to know that I did iron my panties for this interview.
I'm very glad to hear that.
Yes.
Now, Steve, you expect people to be angered by this manifesto. So first, can you establish your sort of street cred as a fan from an early age? Why did you love the game?
Well, I started watching, I think like most fans, I started watching because my dad watched football. And I think sports in general and football especially is really a way that little boys especially can kind of bond with their fathers and in some larger sense maybe be initiated into the world of men. So I watched a lot of football. I became very attached to the Oakland Raiders only because they were super good when I was growing up. And they were the, you know, I should have rooted for the San Francisco 49ers because they were closer, but they were terrible. So I rooted for the Raiders. And I really have found that it's ebbed and and flowed, waxed and waned. But I really, when I'm especially stressed out or even lonely, the games have taken on incredible importance. So I would like sneak off every Sunday when I was in graduate school, for instance. I would wander up to campus and just try to find a TV. But I totally hid it from everybody else in my life, like a drug addiction, really. Mm-hmm.
You describe it. There's a quote from Caroline Knapp's book, Drinking a Love Story, as you sort mm-hmm. of secretly kind of hiding yourself in this atmosphere that you don't realize is not your friend necessarily.
Yeah. I mean, the way I would say is that like any passion that we have, you turn to it in order to experience feelings that you can't reach by other means. But those feelings are very complicated for me because on the one hand, I was totally absorbed by the games. But afterwards, there was this weird feeling of just guilt and shame. And I was just like really a regressed feeling, which is probably how you should feel when you're a grown man, who has sort of important business to do in the world and you're shut into a giant emporium filled with chicken wings watching giant men in tight pants bash one another's skulls. That's probably not going to rank as like super mature behavior.
But it does bring back some sense of that unfettered play and leaping and throwing in childhood for you. And you quote other writers who've described similar feelings. Your own description yep. of being a kid, playing the game, pretending not to be afraid. You all feel kind of united and feel tested. You hurt yourself badly a few times and accepted the pain. Is that right. the footballer's creed? You just keep going.
Well, I think it's sort of like I think of football as a kind of exalted cult of masculinity. And it represents these ideals of courage, fearlessness, self-sacrifice to a greater cause. I mean, there's even a kind of muscular Christianity that I think is folded into our feelings about the game. After all, we go to worship on Sunday, right?
Right.
And, I also feel like in its purest form, football is this reconnection to the intuitive joys of childhood, the stuff you're talking about, leaping and jumping, catching, throwing, tackling, trying to evade someone. I took part in those, and I love watching that in football. The problem is that all that amazing, beautiful, heroic stuff is attached to all these very dark moral hazards that most fans, myself included, just want nothing to do with. We just don't want to look at it at all.
Well, let's get to some of those. We now know about the accumulated impact of all of those, beautiful-looking plays, those lambs to the slaughter on some level in both professional league football, in college football, high school, and kids. Give us a yep. little bit on the data of what actually is happening to players' brains after hitting each other over and over and over again.
So the NFL spent a long time denying that there was any link between concussions and brain damage or brain trauma illnesses. And that after a while, it just became obvious enough medical research emerged, and frankly, enough famous football players wound up killing themselves in flamboyant ways and then had their brains autopsied, and they found that there was this illness called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE is how it's known. It's basically a form of dementia, and it comes from not just from catastrophic hits. It actually, just as dangerous, if not more dangerous, because they're invisible, are all the minor subconcussive hits that footballers experience every single play of every single practice, just those little car collisions inside their helmets that don't register as a concussion or even an injury, but they are in fact the brain's a soft organ slamming against the skull. And the result is that in some players, they develop dementia, oftentimes years after they've played. But the really scary thing for me is, for instance, the study they did, a bunch of researchers did a couple of years ago at Purdue University. The researchers wanted to find out, what's the effect of concussions in high school football players? So they put sensors in a couple of dozen high school football players' helmets and found that they're actually just trying to see what's the effect of concussions. So they set up this control group of kids who'd never gotten any concussions, and they gave them, tests to determine their brain activity. Here's where it gets terrifying. It turns out that even the kids in the control group showed diminished brain function, and that diminishing got worse and worse as the year wore on, so that by the end of the year, some of them had no actual brain function in portions of their frontal lobes. That, to anybody who's a parent or a school administrator or just a sentient human being, should be deeply terrifying. The idea that we send kids to high school to get smarter, to have more brain activity, and in fact, by playing football, they show diminished brain activity.
And these are subconcussive hits in many cases. 65,000 reported concussions a year among high school players. Now, the argument, of course, is that football is a way for young boys to work out their aggressions. You know, these are our would-be warriors. They're not going to stay home and crochet, as one of the commenters said in response to your manifesto. And that players understand the risks of the game, and especially in pro sports, are very, very well paid to sustain those risks. So they have free will. What's your argument to that?
Well, look, I, like every other fan, carry around my little suitcase of rationalizations and excuses. And every fall, I unpack it. And the first one I take out is, oh, they get paid a lot. That's their choice. They're adults and so forth. And there are a couple things to say about that. First, we're really not talking about the players. My book is really trying to say, hey, the moral equation you need to be paying attention to is your culpability as a fan. If you watch football, believe me, the NFL doesn't just see you as a fan. You're a consumer. You are feeding the $10 billion a year industry that is the NFL. And you're also making the decision that you feel it's morally acceptable to watch as a form of entertainment a game in which men might suffer brain damage, that you think that that is okay. Whether you want to face it or not, that's the decision you're making. So the first thing I'd say is it's not about the players. It's about the fans. We're the ones who built the football industrial complex. And if it's ever going to change, we're the ones who are going to have to change it.
We're talking with the writer Steve Allman about the sport that he love-hates, football.
That's right. My frenemy. My frenemy, the NFL.
Your frenemy, the NFL. His new book is called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Raises a number of questions about America's relationship to football. It is our worship of the game, he argues, that blinds us to its pathologies. How about these behavior issues? We may have notions of what goes on inside of the locker room, this kind of jockish misogyny, homophobia. How are we as game fans complicit with that?
Well, you know, it's hard to talk about this stuff because basically football is a place that I think Americans go, mostly males, but plenty of women as well, to not think about this stuff. It really has essentially the values of like maybe the 1850s, you know, in terms of how men and women are defined. And if you really just step away from the game, as I painfully have been doing over the past few months, it becomes much clearer. I mean, it's just men play. They're all hugely muscled men. They're all super aggressive. They are selected to be super aggressive and savage. And that's actually what makes them good, is that they're able to dull out their empathy and hit somebody hard, put them on the ground, hopefully put them out of the game. Women are pictured on the sidelines jiggling, or maybe being a pretty fan in the stands, or the girlfriend or the wife of some player. And those are gender roles that are not modern gender roles. Nowhere else in American culture other than athletics can you really see that kind of like incredibly narrow idea of what a man or a woman is. Every time that there's a player like Ray Rice, the Baltimore Ravens running back, who allegedly punched his girlfriend and knocked her out, right? And there's the video of him dragging her out of an elevator. And, you know, he got punished by missing two games. And he also, you know, wound up not having to spend any time in jail. If he was somebody other than a football player, if he was an undocumented worker, if he was just a poor person in this country, if he wasn't a celebrity and especially a famous athlete, he just wouldn't have gotten the same treatment. We give these guys incredible power, status, prerogative, and we really need them so badly, whatever they supply us, that we not only welcome them back with a slap on the wrist, but there were fans who were actually applauding when he returned to the practice field, some of whom I suspect have daughters or wives or, you know, sisters who are the same age as the girl, as the young woman that he allegedly punched and knocked out. That's some bad values that we are taking in and expressing through football.
Well, we don't think about football in moral terms, as you said just a moment ago. So will reading this book ruin the game for football fans, and should it?
My hope is that the book will start a conversation so that fans are forced not to quit the game, but to fully confront what it is they're watching.
Steve Allman, he writes commentary, journalism, fiction, and soon to be a whipping post, is my guest. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
I'm glad you're so optimistic. Thank you.
Steve's new book is called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. So what do you think? Has the game been ruined for you? Is merely watching a sport that you have some objections to being complicit? Or as one headline criticized Steve's manifesto, Steve Almond, wah, wah, wah. You can weigh in yourself on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter, @wordofmouth. We'd love to hear from you. And we're going to continue with the story of a New Hampshire family that's downsizing in a major way. Breck and Beck Palumbo have just sold most of their belongings and moved themselves and their three young children out of a 3,000-square-foot home in Exeter and into a 240-square-foot RV. They're not downsizing because they have to, but because they want to. NHPR Seacoast reporter Emily Corwin recently paid him a visit.
Breck Palumbo runs a software company from a home office. He and his wife, Becky, a stay-at-home mom, have cultivated a kind of flexibility their parents never dreamed of. They can live anywhere they want to. The problem is, they haven't found that perfect place.
And then we thought, well, why don't we just go find where we should be?
Like a lot of middle-class families untethered to offices thanks to the internet, the Palumbos are searching for the there, a place to put down roots.
I mean, I'd like to have more people in the kind of business that I'm in.
Local food scene, good restaurants.
Outdoor recreation.
Some alternative school options.
People who have the same sort of values.
So the Palumbos are setting out for a year with their three kids and a dog in a shiny Airstream RV.
This is called a safari bunk. It's like just shy of 31 feet.
Pretty much everything in here folds. Breck has a folding monitor he plugs into his folding laptop. The kitchen cutting board folds down, even the couch.
So this folds down to a bed, and this is where Enzo will sleep, he's not quite two.
The bunks are in the back.
This is where I sometimes sleep, and that's where Madeline sometimes sleeps.
Vince is five. He calls his sister Malin.
My name is Madeline, and I am 7 years old.
They're setting off this week, heading south for the winter, west to California, then up along the Pacific coast next spring.
So we're starting in Old Orchard Beach, then we're going to go to Great Barrington, Raystown Lake, Gettysburg, Asheville, maybe Atlanta, Austin, Portland. I really want to get to Victoria, BC. After that, I don't care what happens.
Left behind in New Hampshire are 7-year-old Madeline's school and friends. From now on, this silver Airstream will be her schoolhouse, and little Vince, her only classmate.
So you've never done homeschool before. Are you excited about it?
Yes.
What are you excited about?
That my parents will be my teachers.
You're going to miss having lots of little kids around like you do at school?
Kind of.
The Palumbos are not the only family traversing the country with kids in an RV. In fact, there's a whole movement of so-called road schoolers. The website familiesontheroad.com has a list of 320 families who've homeschooled from their RVs over the last 10 years. This family's adventure is about more than just finding that perfect place with good people and plenty of local food. For Breck and Becky, this giant year-long adventure is in part an ideological rebellion.
I'm really looking forward to having our schedule be entirely our own.
Breck and Becky don't like the expectations of modern middle-class parenthood. Not the standardized tests, not the after-school activities, and especially not all the stuff that comes with it. So the Palumbos spent the summer purging.
So I got this bucket, the baby got that bucket, and Vince got that bucket.
Each kid went from a bedroom full of stuff to one small plastic bucket. Madeline points out the things she didn't give away.
This doll, my bunny, I put some little dollhouse characters, I put my diary.
Becky is hopeful their new life will be simpler, easier.
As the stay-at-home mom, I feel like so much of my day is spent taking care of our stuff.
in a smaller space. I am sort of looking, it's going to be an interesting experiment. It's a lot smaller of a space to take care of.
But like she says, it's an experiment. In 2012, another road schooling family with three kids returned to San Diego after 2 years on the road. Father Jason Robillard says living with less is simpler, but it's certainly not serene.
It's very chaotic because you have so many people crammed into a small area. It is difficult to have any sort of private time or quiet time away from everybody else.
7-year-old Madeline and 5-year-old Vince have no idea what to expect on their great big American adventure.
Climbing a cactus. Then one part of the year it will be like just baby animals.
But I suppose their parents don't really know what they're getting into either. For Word of Mouth, I'm Emily Corwin.
Thanks so much for joining us today. If you did like what you heard, there is plenty more at wordofmouthradio.org. We also invite you to follow us and send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most interesting stories travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more of them right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.